letter to the Ephesians was written when Paul was a prisoner, and it was probably when he was a prisoner in Rome in about AD 61. Onesimus, who is a runaway slave of Philemon, had found Paul in Rome and became a convert to Christianity. And Paul befriended him and sent him back with a letter to his owner, Philemon. And along with Philemon went Tychicus, who carried a letter to the Colossians, because that is where Philemon lived. And it's very likely that at the time that he carried the letter to the Colossians, he also carried a letter, this letter to the Ephesians also. There's a lot of similarity between the two letters. The letter to Colossae was dealing with specific problems at Colossae, whereas the letter to the Ephesians was more of a general one, and it reads almost as if Paul wrote the Ephesians after he wrote the Colossians. There's no specific problems that he's dealing with specific to those people at Ephesus. And Ephesians has been described as, and I quote, perhaps the profoundest book in existence. So that's quite a recommendation, really. I think the point that it's James Stalker wrote that in his Life of Paul. And it's interesting, really, because the point he was making was that the book of Ephesians is packed with very spiritual matter. And it's interesting for us to consider that this was within 10 years of Paul arriving at Ephesus, probably less, the people there were ready to receive such enlightened writings. That is something that we won't be looking at today, because that's what carries on with the series about the book Letter to the Ephesians. So tonight we're going to consider the background to Paul's letter to the Ephesians. And I've particularly focused my thoughts on Paul's experience at the city of Ephesus. Most of the readings that we look at will be taken from Acts 18, especially 19, and also 20. And we will have some maps as well to help us to make sense of what we're reading. So perhaps first of all, we've got this map ready, which is a map of where Ephesus was situated in the Roman world. So Paul's first visit to Ephesus is mentioned in Acts chapter 18. He had left Corinth, and actually this is being the map of the second missionary journey. This shows it quite well, really. He left Corinth, he went to Kenthrea, and then he crossed over to Ephesus on his way back home to where he'd come from. So it was probably that when he left Ephesus, it was probably late summer. We know that because of the travelling times were very much governed by the weather, both across the land and also across the sea. You could not travel easily between about October, November time, or right the way through to March time. The overland was very difficult to cross, especially through the wilds of Galatia, and again on the sea it was also difficult, as we know from later experiences that Paul had, if you were travelling at the wrong time of the year. So we can work out how long it took him to cross and how long it took him to cross back. So it probably was that he left there about late summer. It would be either AD 51 or 52. Acts chapter 18 verse 19 tells us this, and I'm using the English Standard Version. Acts 18 verse 19, they came to Ephesus, and Paul left Priscilla and Aquila there, but he himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer period, he declined. But taking leave of them, he said, I will return to you if God wills. And he set sail for Ephesus. So Paul was now briefly returning to get his breath back, I suppose, and collect himself together. And that was the end of what we call the second missionary journey of Paul. But he had left Aquila and Priscilla at Ephesus in order to set up for himself a base to which he could return. I expect we all know that this husband and wife team were tent makers and fabric workers like Paul, and they would be able to supply Paul with manual work because he did like to work at the same time as preaching, in order that he could support himself financially and set a good example to the converts. Now, we know from the 1st of Corinthians 16 that later Aquila and Priscilla would have a house church at their house. So they were there for more than just his coming back to work manually. And indeed, their missionary work began during Paul's absence, when another fascinating personality turned up on the scene at Ephesus. And that was Apollos, as we read in Acts 18, verse 24. So remember now, Paul is away, he's gone back, and during this time, we read, "Now a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, competent in the scriptures. And he, we've read, came from Alexandria, down there. And he'd been travelling around and turned up at Ephesus." Now, we do know that the Jews at Alexandria, in fact, people in general at Alexandria, the place there was well known for teaching people the art of rhetoric. And it seems as though Apollos had learned that well, because we read that he was eloquent and competent, and he was able to really, really, once he understood the gospel, he was able to become a great exponent of it. Apollos had somehow learned about Christianity, but not fully. Verse 26, it says, "He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him and explained the way of God more accurately." So they either took him to one side, or they maybe took him home. And he obviously listened to them, learned as much as he could, and then he crossed over to Corinth, and he would later return to Ephesus and work alongside Paul. But for the time being, Apollos then went over to Corinth. And Paul, as he promised the Ephesians, did come back to Ephesus. He travelled overland through Galatia, so that would be across here, and instead of doing what he did on his second journey, going up there, he crossed across to Ephesus. He probably arrived in April. No, he set off in April, probably arrived in August. That was the length of time it actually took to cross that area. And we know that Paul remained in Ephesus for at least 2.25 years, perhaps slightly more. He rounds it up in his own terms to about 3 years. And that was the longest time that Paul spent anywhere. It became a very important base for him. Right, looking at the map, we can see why Ephesus was such a convenient place for Paul. Obviously, we know that Paul was directed by the Spirit of Christ as to exactly where he was going to set up shop. He had probably intended to head to Ephesus on his second journey, but he'd been redirected. But this time, Ephesus was the place for him. And we can see why, really, when we look at the map. If we had a larger map, but you'll have to use your imagination, and if you imagine the Roman Empire, so it comes along the bottom here towards the top of Africa, it goes that way to Rome and right the way to Spain, then the Roman Empire formed like a ribbon all the way around the rim of the Mediterranean. And as we all know from the New Testament, the Asia itself, Asia Minor, which is now Western Turkey, had a lot of very important cities in it, and some of them are mentioned on the map. Ephesus was the leading city of Asia Minor. It was very important commercially because it stood at the end of the Asian caravan routes, and it was a convenient landing place from Rome. And from both sea and land, it was a very key centre in the Roman world. It had a harbour, and its harbour opened onto the Aegean. And it was a springboard for Paul, really, in the way that Corinth also was. By establishing a centre here, then travellers and traders, who would be coming and going all of the time, would begin to take the seeds of Christianity on every sea and land route that radiated out from that point, so that the gospel was able to spread further than Paul himself could ever hope to have personally reached. And more importantly, perhaps, in the short term, Ephesus held a very central point of communication to those centres that Paul had already established on his journey. Paul showed a lot of strategy in the way that he operated. We're thinking about fairly long distances, but it was a central point in many ways. From Ephesus to Galatia, and Galatia would be sort of an area about there, was less than 300 miles, more than 250 miles. To Thessalonica, up north, it was a similar distance, about 290 miles as the crow flies. To Corinth, it was about 240 miles. To Philippi, 267 miles. And Pisidian Antioch, which is there, about 200 miles. So thinking about 200 miles plus in each direction, Paul was able to send ambassadors to receive news and to send letters. So you can see why he liked it there. And in terms of future missionary work, Ephesus would prove to be a very well chosen spot, since from here it was possible to reach the Lysus Valley. The Lysus Valley included Hierapolis, Laodicea and Colossae, which were communities that Paul himself didn't visit initially. He didn't found them, but it seems as though he sent Epaphras, or at least Epaphras, who was an assistant of him, went over there and was able to set up believing communities in those areas. And then, of course, Paul was able to write to those as well and receive news from them. In addition to that, we read that Paul later successfully managed to get things going over at Troas, which was halfway between Ephesus and Philippi. He could later write to the Corinthians and he could say to them, all the churches in Asia Minor, salute you. And he could write a letter to the Romans in which he said, I no longer have any room for work in these regions. And he was writing from Asia Minor. So Paul did a lot of work in that region. Much of it was based in Ephesus. Looking at Acts chapter 19, verse 26, we see how successful he was. The person who was speaking wasn't really wishing to compliment Paul, but nevertheless he shows us how well Paul did. These are the words of Demetrius the silversmith, and he's complaining. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but almost in all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. So from that, it's interesting when we consider the way that Paul went about preaching his mission. We see from Acts chapter 19, verse 37, the town clerk is speaking out against Demetrius, who's caused a whole lot of trouble, and he's really defending Paul, and he shows Paul's methods. He says, you have brought here these men who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. So that's interesting, isn't it? Paul clearly was not disrespectful about the pagans, as we see at Athens and at Lystra, and also amongst the Jews. Paul would use reason and he would rationally talk about his beliefs in a very accessible way. And he would find a common background between the two of them, and then he would go on to give a completely unequivocal message that gods made with hands are not gods at all. And similarly with the Jews, he made very clear that salvation was through Jesus. Well, we'll just have a little historical digression. It's often pointed out that Luke was a very accurate historian. And this is useful to us because if we look at Acts chapter 19, verse 38, there's a little detail, just one word really, in a way, which helps us to fix the date that this riot that we've read about happened when Paul's friends were taken to the theatre. The town clerk there says there are proconsuls. In other words, you can go to the proconsuls if you want to sort this out. Now, normally there was only ever one proconsul, but this was a time, and it was in AD 54 when the proconsul of Asia was poisoned by his subordinates. Nero had just come to power, and these two people had poisoned the proconsul, and their names were Helius and Sella. And they actually took the role of proconsuls. So just for a short time, there were two proconsuls, and hence we see the accuracy here of Luke. Now, historically, the city of Ephesus was already a millennia and a half old by the time of Paul. It was a really ancient city. It had been moved slightly because it was situated near to the river, the river Caister, but the river was continually silting up, and in the end they got so fed up of dredging it, they moved it west, and it was rebuilt 300 years BC or so by a friend of Alexander the Great, Lysimachus, and subsequently to that Augustus and various other people had enhanced this city more. So that by the time that Paul was there, the city was full of awe-inspiring architectural structures. The ruins that we will look at one or two in a minute covered a very large area. Well, there weren't ruins then, but the ruins that we could have covered nowadays cover a very large area, and they have been described as being the most extensive and impressive of anywhere in Asia Minor. So there's a lot of archaeology going on in this area. And there have been found to be temples there. There were three of them. There was a town hall, there were theatres, a library, there were gymnasiums, squares, baths, gateways and pavements. And you can get plans of different parts of Ephesus, and you even have little details on them like public toilets. It's quite amazing that this was a real urban area, rather similar, not entirely dissimilar to the world we live in now. So we're going to look at one or two pictures of Ephesus, things that Paul would have seen. Now this is a site that Paul would not have seen because it's from the air, but it shows us the area of the ruins, which I take it presumably must be contained within there. The next show us from a distance a shot of Ephesus, and there we have the last remaining column which shows us where the temple to Artemis was. So that still survives, that's about all that's left. The next slide will show us the gate through which Paul would have walked through when he first turned up at Ephesus, called the Magnesian Gate, and that's all that's left of them. But obviously when Paul walked through them, the place was bustling and industrious and a very exciting place to be, I'm sure. So having passed through the Magnesian Gate, Paul would have come at some point to the Magnesian, to the main walkway that took you down from the gates, and it would be heading downhill towards the harbour. Again, it's somewhere that Paul would have walked, I'm sure, during his 2.5 years for many times and become very familiar with. And again, we imagine it in its past glory, bustling with industry. Finally, we have a plan, and this is just a little plan of part of the ancient inner city. So that there's the Celsus Library, for example. Must have been a fascinating place for Paul to walk around when he had, if he ever did have, some spare time. Thanks very much. Now we don't actually have any photographs of these, but the two most impressive features of Paul's day at Ephesus were both mentioned in our introductory reading in Acts 19, and they were witnesses, if you like, silent witnesses of the success of his preaching. The first landmark was the Temple of Artemis, and it's known as Diana in the AV and the New King James. That clear was, as we've read, a place that was becoming, due to Paul's preaching efforts, it was declining in the attendance of its devotees. The Temple to Artemis was the largest building in the Greek world, so that's pretty big. It was famous for its architectural splendour. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. If you're good at imagining dimensions, it was 115 metres by 55 metres. So that is pretty big. It was made of marble, and it housed an image of the goddess Artemis. As we've read, they claim that this image had fallen from the sky, so we might speculate that perhaps it was a meteorite, and they'd seen it as something that was sacred, and that's what was inside the temple, at least at some point. The temple had been founded in 7 centuries BC. It had been built on quite a few, rebuilt and enlarged on many occasions, and it actually survived until the barbarians finally destroyed it in the 3rd century, so it lasted a very long time. Associated with worship at that temple, as Luke mentions, was the manufacture and sale of small shrines, and they were made in honour of Artemis, who was held to be the mother of the gods, so she had a very important role in the ancient world's eyes. She'd been worshipped from time immemorial in those parts, and we might wonder if she's perhaps a predecessor of Mary worship. The ornaments that were made of silver or marble, or if you couldn't afford either of those, then you might have gone for a terracotta one. They were kept in houses, they were buried with the dead, and they were presented to the temple priests, who every now and then rounded up all the terracotta ones and shoveled them out of the way because they weren't worth a lot. But I expect they held on to the silver ones, so there's large amounts of destroyed terracotta images to Artemis. The pilgrims who were attracted to the city came from all around the world, and the temple worship, all this was a very significant factor in the economy. Also for civic identity, and we know that coins were struck proclaiming what we've also read, that Ephesus was the guardian of the temple of Artemis. Then rivaling that particular structure, that huge enormous temple, was also in another enormous structure. It was an outdoor theatre which could seat 25,000 people. So that would be, in terms of modern football supporting, that would be a fairly big crowd. That is mentioned in Acts 19, verse 29, and that's where Paul's companions were dragged during the riot. This theatre was regularly used as a meeting place for the civic assembly, and it was interestingly enough known as the Ecclesia at Ephesus. That's what in those days an Ecclesia was. In Acts 19 verse 35 we find a reference to one of the officials that presided over this. In my version here he's called a town clerk, but the Greek title was the grammateur. And verse 35 begins that the grammateur quietened the crowd. Now we know from inscriptions that have been discovered that the grammateur could personally be held responsible by the Romans for any breach of peace, such as this illegal assembly which had taken place at the time of Paul. And so we can understand very naturally his desire to dampen matters down as soon as he possibly could. In verse 31, we also have a reference to those known, as the ESV calls them, the Asiarchs. The Asiarchs of Ephesus, as we know from historians, were 10 in number, and they were selected from the most wealthy of its citizens. And they were actually responsible for overseeing the temple worship. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because in verse 31, we find that these acted in a very friendly manner towards Paul. They were concerned for his safety. So that we can see that Paul was making quite an impression, even amongst the higher end of society. Some of it was favourable, some unfavourable. But he certainly made an impact. So Ephesus was a free town, which meant that they did have a certain amount of room to do what they wanted, but of course the Romans were very tolerant of those who cooperated with them. They did keep an eye on proceedings, which this grammateur was very aware of. The size of the place is quite staggering, really. In terms of its population, it was about 250,000 people lived there, possibly up to 250,000. So it was one of the most highly populated cities of its day. It ranked alongside Rome and Alexandria and Antioch. It was, for the reason of its size and also of its location, it was a melting pot society containing every element and every social strata, from the fabulously wealthy, from the powerful, right down to the very humblest of slaves. And there were many cultures existing alongside each other. People tended to come, this meeting point of two different worlds, and people tended to go that far and then stop within Ephesus. So it collected all sorts of people, many competing pagan religions. And yet, at this time of history, paganism was, in its crudest sense at least, becoming a spent force. Christianity, in comparison, was something vibrant and something new, and it could appeal to all levels of society. It was offering something completely different to what the worn-out paganism did. It's interesting, I've been reading recently a book by Gibbon about it's called Christianity and the Fall of Rome. And it's very interesting to see, he analyses the difference between the old way and the new, and shows how Christianity really did appeal to people at all levels of society. It lifted some up to give them real dignity that they never had before. And for those who were wealthy, it was offering them something spiritual which their own religion just really lacked. Pagan religion at that time was just one of those things you did as an everyday duty, and nobody really thought much about what they were doing. So we can imagine that as Paul was there, and as he was working away, and as he was speaking, no doubt as he worked, that the believers began to form around him. And they would have contained a microcosm of the city itself, perhaps one or two wealthy ones, probably quite a few traders and craftsmen, and no doubt lowly slaves as well. No doubt the community would have contained as many female members as male, because again, whereas other religions tended to be exploitative of females, this offered them dignity and a place. It's just a little thought as well. We've read in about some people that Paul met, about 12 of them, it said. They'd heard about Jesus, well, they'd heard about the baptism of John, and he had to tell them more. Then they were baptised. They received the Holy Spirit, and one of the gifts they were given was to be able to speak in tongues. Well, you can see really why at a place like Ephesus, to be able to speak in foreign languages and dialects would be, if not essential, then it would be a very, very useful tool to be able to spread the gospel. And we certainly see at this time the gospel spreading like a fire, like a wildfire through that region. And Paul had an interesting strategy when he went around. He would turn up in the city, and Ephesus is certainly, as we've read, it's a similar similar thing that he did, that he would visit the local synagogue first of all. It would be a custom in the synagogues that if a visiting rabbi or preacher came along, and Paul was certainly a person with all of the intellectual qualifications that you could look for, somebody like that, and Apollos also, would be invited to speak by the synagogue ruler. They'd go to the synagogue and they would be offered an opportunity. And for Paul, you can see why he took this opportunity, because synagogues would provide a ready-made premises where an assembly would regularly come together, people who knew their scriptures very well. And Paul's mission statement, if you like, was first to the Jew and then to the Greek. So that's how he did it, and the synagogue was the place to begin. Now, at the synagogue, obviously, there would be Jews, but also there would be non-Jews also. There would have been proselytes, people who had gone through the full process of conversion to Judaism. And also, significantly, there would have been God-fearing Gentiles who associated there too. These would have been people who would not have really relished going through the painful rite of circumcision, and who were probably quite mind-boggled by all of the ritual and requirement and custom of the law. Obviously some of it was from Moses, and that would have been hard in its own right. But in addition to that, the Jews by this time had got so many extra traditions and customs that Gentiles, some of them at least, could see the wisdom of monotheism, of a God without an image. They could see how noble the underlying spirit behind the law was, but they couldn't bring themselves to become full Jews. And so Paul was able to bring Christianity to such people, and such people very frequently, and grabbed it with both hands. But Paul, when he went into a synagogue, knew by painful experience that he could not take for granted that he would get a friendly reception when he spoke. Very frequently the Jews were envious of the impact which the gospel had on their Gentile friends. Understandably, they also felt very uncomfortable when Paul started stripping away the requirements of the laws, both the legitimate ones that had been up until Christ, and also their extra bolt-on practices, which had almost encrusted themselves around the Mosaic law. They began to envy the fact that the Gentiles were turning away from them and towards Paul. We really do owe Paul an enormous debt, really, the fact that he persevered with insisting upon the fact that it's, particularly for Gentiles, it did no longer matter about the law of Moses. Without his work and people like him, Christianity would have remained probably a very second-rate, obscure sect of Judaism. But he had the courage and stamina, and he was obviously blessed by God, and he was able to really make that point. And so now we are free of all those things, and it's something that we're very grateful for. At Ephesus, it wasn't instantly as though he was seen to the door. Some places they pretty much dragged him out of the synagogue and stoned him or chased him out, and he couldn't even remain in the city. It was better at Ephesus. Acts 19 verse 8. And Paul entered the synagogue and for 3 months spoke boldly, reasoning and persuading them about the kingdom of God. But when some became stubborn Anne's continued in unbelief, speaking evil of the way before the congregation. He withdrew from them and took the disciples with him, reasoning daily in the hall of Tyrannus. This continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. So that synagogue did tolerate Paul for longer than many, and it seems as though withdrawal was his decision, because it was as if he was just generating more heat than light. And he set up in this lecture hall. We don't know where in Ephesus that was, but what we do know is that it belonged to Tyrannus, who was probably a lecturer or a philosopher or a rhetorician. It seems likely, as one of the Bible texts, not the most accurate, the Western text, suggests that he probably used the place between 11 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock. That is a very likely thing, because what happened was that it was too hot at that time of day for most people, and so while the students of Tyrannus were having their rest, then Paul and his friends and interested audience would come together in this lecture hall while everybody else had their siesta and went off and had a quiet time. Paul could then use that lecture hall and they would get deep into study, and we can imagine just what a fascinating time they must have had with Paul. But Paul didn't just preach. We find from Acts 19, and just looking really at verses 11 to 20, something we've read, we don't need to go into too much detail, but we find that Paul is working miracles in order to underpin the authority of the gospel that he preached. We know from historians like F.F. Bruce that Ephesus in those days in the Greek world was known as a centre for magic and sorcery. There was one kind of magic formula that was actually named after the place. It was called Ephesia Grammata. And you can imagine all of the accompanying mumbo jumbo that went on with all this sort of religion, books of spells we've read about, haven't we? All of the empty philosophy that went with that magic. And yet, as they listened to Paul, as they saw the power that he was using, they became aware that his authority was of a completely different nature to the false trickery of his rivals. I guess a lot of the more educated ones realised that there was trickery. And it's interesting also that some of the magicians, some of the people performing these tricks, when they looked at what Paul was doing, they basically thought, yeah, this is a sham. And as a public proclamation, turning their back on what they'd done before and making a statement really by doing so, they burnt their books, and they were worth a lot of money, as we've read. And just at the end of verse 20, which just sort of makes the point, so the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. Paul really was making an impact there. Shortly we're going to look at Acts chapter 20, but just briefly I'd like to look at a verse from that before we come back to it later in a bit more depth. Acts 20 verse 20, Paul says this to the Ephesian elders: I did not shrink back from declaring to you anything that was profitable and teaching you in public and from house to house. So we can see then that while Paul was at Ephesus, he used every venue that was available to him, private and public. He went also from house to house. Now, from 1 Corinthians, we read of Paul who spoke of the church at the house of Aquila and Priscilla. He wrote that letter from Ephesus, which shows then that people met to worship in people's houses. Obviously at the moment there was no sufficient funds yet to set aside a particular building for worship. And so what they had to do was to meet in each other's houses. Those who were wealthy enough would have a meeting in their own house. Thinking about the sort of numbers that there would be at Ephesus, no doubt there had to be several of such houses where people met. And you certainly get that from the reading about the Corinthians. It seems as though there would be different groups of believers who sometimes met together for full communal worship. We're going to quickly look at some pictures of houses to show the kind of houses that possibly were used. These are terraced houses, houses not so big. It's very unlikely that the wealthiest of people became believers, but houses big enough to accommodate perhaps 15, 20 believers huddled together in a room like Aquila's and Priscilla's. Just look at another picture which shows close up the kind of house that they met. Well, you never know, might well have used with frescoes on the wall. And finally, we just out of interest, really, there's a mosaic on the floor of one of them. So that dates back to, I suppose, similar times to Paul. You can imagine when he wrote about fighting wild beasts at Ephesus, perhaps he was looking down at the floor. Just like thinking about that, thanks, Donald. Just thinking about the hard time that Paul had at Ephesus, he does speak about fighting wild beasts. There was no amphitheatre there. It must be that he's speaking metaphorically, but it does show that he was facing really stiff opposition. He also writes to the Corinthians from Ephesus an optimistic but a brave note. He says, I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective work is opened for me, and there are many adversaries. A little bit later, when he's writing from Macedonia, he writes to the Corinthians again. He writes of being so utterly crushed that we despaired of life itself. So sometimes the going was very hard for Paul. It was very challenging. Right, just to complete, I'd just like to read some words where he's reminding the Ephesian elders of the time that he spent amongst them. There's several things that come to mind as we read it, but one is that he was warning them that after he'd gone, then they would face problems with people bringing in false beliefs, and it would come from amongst the elders themselves. That was one thing. He also... speaks of being amongst them with tears, admonishing them with tears. And the other thing I'd like you to notice is the affection that they had for Paul. So just to kind of work out the kind of impact that Paul had whilst he was with these people, we notice how they felt when they said goodbye to him. So, Acts chapter 20 and verse 18. When they came to him, he said to them, you know yourselves how I lived among you from the whole time, from the first day that I set foot in Asia, serving the Lord with humility and with tears and with trials that happened to me through the plots of the Jews, how I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable and teaching you in public and from house to house, testifying to both Jews and to Greeks of repentance toward God and of faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. I'll just skip through to the end. Verse 36. When he had said these things, he knelt down and prayed with them all. There was much weeping on the part of them all. They embraced Paul and kissed him, being sorrowful, most of all because the word he had spoken, that they would not see his face again, and they accompanied him to the ship.